As most of you know, or perhaps all, I have been going through a three-part series about self-righteousness, and this is the last part of the series, of the three-part series. And if you missed the first two, I would encourage you either to go online to our church website here and listen to them, because they all dovetail together, or you could see Mr. Davis in the back, and he could make you a copy of the either of the first two. Point number one that we went through was self-righteousness as developed through obedience, which I think shocked some people. But of course, this was the major problem that Jesus Christ faced during his day, that the self-righteousness of the Pharisees was so extant that he just constantly had to battle against it. And then part two was self-righteousness developed through complacency, the total opposite of the first one, because they dotted every I, they crossed every T, they made sure that they did everything to appear righteous before men. They added a lot to God's law. God's law wasn't enough, and they had to go above and beyond in their, quote, obedience, end quote. Part three that I want to go through today is self-righteousness developed through trials and tests. We learned at the end of the sermon a couple of weeks ago on part two that about complacency, that correction and trials and tests are to produce, as we read, the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Each one of us goes through various trials and tests. We have a life pretty well of trials and tests, problems that we have to face and so forth. We have traumas in our life. We have temptation. We have headaches and heartaches, and sometimes heartbreaks in our lives, or things that happen. We go through sometimes defeat. We go through discouragement. But inherent within all of the trials and the tests is a tremendous potential for the infection of this dreaded destroyer of Christians, and that is self-righteousness. The same identical tool, as you have heard me state before, God uses to develop his character, his mind, his nature in us, Satan the devil uses to destroy us. God uses it to build gods. Satan uses it to destroy potential gods. And of course, that same tool is trials and tests. For this point, I want to cover much of the book of Job. We're going to go through it. Most scholars feel that Job was the first book actually written in the Bible, that it predates the book of Genesis. Some scholars feel that Job was probably a priest. I don't know one way or the other. But the book of Job does point out a serious problem that Satan has perfected to destroy potential gods. A problem of self-righteousness, and a problem that we have to avoid and overcome. Job is the key, I think, to understanding suffering, and the key to understanding self-righteousness. In Job 1 and verse 1, says there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. The King James Version says that Job was perfect and upright. Now that's quite a statement. I've mentioned before that I personally do not believe that Job was self-righteous. I believe that Job became self-righteous because of the trials and the tests that he went through that we will cover today. If Job had the terrible sin of self-righteousness, God could have not have said that he was perfect and one who eschewed or hated or shunned evil. In the Brown Driver Briggs Hebrew Dictionary, it says perfect means perfect, complete, one who lacks nothing in physical strength or beauty. It means to be sound, wholesome, It can describe an ordinary, quiet sort of a person. Means to be complete, morally innocent, having integrity, one who is morally and ethically pure. God doesn't say things like that about people that have the sin of self-righteousness. God doesn't take that very lightly. I do not believe that Job was self-righteous. And as far as I know, God did not say that about anybody else in the Old Testament, that they were perfect. In verse 8, Job 1, and verse 8 through 12, "Then the Lord said unto Satan, Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" And so here God had a lot of faith in Job. God had put a lot of trust in him, as we're going to see. So Satan answered the Lord in verse 9 and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and his household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." God said, no, he won't. God had faith in him. He knew that Job was righteous and that Job would not sin. "And behold," he said, "that all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." So Satan immediately left the presence of the Lord. And of course, he went out and, as we're going to see, wreaked absolute havoc. But God had a lot of faith in Job. He knew that Job was a righteous man and that he would remain righteous. When you're bombarded by trials and tests, when life seems like it has no solution and no answer, and you feel like you could walk under a snake's belly with a top hat on, that you're just so low down, you need to stop and realize that if you're going through that severe of a trial, that God places a lot of faith and trust in you. He knew that Job would make it through it. So if it's getting tough, then realize that God has just wrapped his arms around you and is hugging you and saying that he knows you're going to make it. Satan argued that Job was overprotected by God, and no wonder he was perfect because he was blessed in every way. And so in verse 13 through 22, it says, "Now there was a day when the sons and the daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away, indeed they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while in verse 16 he was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another also came. "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Brain can't comprehend it. I think God has built kind of a safety valve in our brain. It's like when a mate dies, it seems like several days before it really, really begins to sink in, and you've had a little bit of time to get adjusted and so forth. And here just wham, 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 one after another, that Satan unleashes his fury on Job. And notice what Job said then. And he rose in verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. God gave, and the Lord takes away. Blessed is the name of the Lord." And in all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God wrongly. What about you? If you had to go through something like that, even in an entire lifetime, much less just in one day that all this happens to you, do you blame God? Do you get upset? Do you get angry with him? I know we all groan and we say, "Oh, that's terrible." But you know, we honestly cannot comprehend that much tragedy and that much grief happening at one time. I lost a son. Most horrible thing I've ever been through in my life. He lost 10 children in one fell swoop. You can't wrap your mind around that. There's no way to comprehend it. And all of his wealth, he was the richest man in the East, and all of his wealth was all of a sudden, just like that, stripped away from him. And despite all this, Job did not sin. He was still righteous. He was still perfect in God's eyes, not self-righteous. Notice Job, the second chapter, beginning in verse 3 through 7. "And then the Lord said unto Satan, Have you considered my servant Job?" Kind of makes you hope God doesn't bring up your name, doesn't it? He said, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless, a upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And he still holds fast to his integrity, although you incite me against him to destroy him without cause." And then Satan answers the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But you stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face." God said, "No, he won't." And the Lord said unto Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life." Again, God had a lot of faith, confidence in Job. So Satan in verse 7 went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of ashes. So here Satan's at it again. This time he attacks Job's body and his physical health. Painful boils, as the King James says, from the top of his head down to the bottom of his feet. Impossible to get comfortable. Impossible. You couldn't lay down. You were miserable. You couldn't sit down. You were miserable. You couldn't stand up. You were absolutely miserable. And so no matter what he did, he was absolutely miserable. And ashes were probably the softest thing that he could find to rest on, and that's why he sat on the ashes. But actually, the Sansino commentary, which is the Jewish commentary of the Old Testament, says these were not boils, but actually a form of elephantitis known as black leprosy. That he had the very horrible disease of black leprosy. And we're going to see later that he even had maggots infesting his rotting, oozing skin. Then we read going on that his wife really helps out the situation, and she just looks at him in his pathetic sense, and she just says, "Why don't you curse God and give up and die?" She was really a helpmeet, wasn't she? She was a big help. Well, then his three friends show up, and they sat like a bump on the log for 7 days. Apparently they didn't eat. They didn't drink. They just sat there and looked at Job for 7 days, without saying a word. And when we find out what they do say, they should have waited till the eighth day. But anyway, God plainly showed what was wrong with Job, or why he was going through that, was not because of sin. But as we'll see, they all three conclude that he had to be suffering because he was sinning. And most of the time, I think our suffering is brought on because of our own personal sins. But sometimes God is perfecting his mind and his heart, his life in us, and he does that through trials and tests. But now things get interesting in Job 3 and verse 1. Job 3 and verse 1 through 4. After this, Job opened his mouth, and he cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness, and may God not seek it, nor the light shine upon it." Now we begin to see a small crack in Job's armor. He now begins to look to himself. He now begins to get despondent and discouraged, and as we're going to see later, even a root of bitterness toward God sets in. But here's the first crack that we find, so to speak. He says, "Why? Why am I going through this? I obey God, I love God, I serve God. There's no reason why I should have to face this." And he felt like he'd be better off if he'd never been born. You ever felt like that? You ever felt like that you just wish that you could have never even been on the face of the earth, that the world would be better off and you would be better off? Has Satan ever got you so discouraged that you just wanted to give up and you wished you could die and even never having been born? Has Satan ever got you with a root of bitterness to set in? So many have been diverted from the path and the road of salvation by a root of bitterness. I cannot comprehend what Job went through, but he began to get discouraged. He began to feel angry. He began to feel sorry for himself. And ultimately, a root of bitterness sets in, as we're going to see, as he begins to blame God. And he felt like he was more righteous than God was. Before we get down and out on Job, again, I think we need to look at what he suffered, what he went through, what he endured, and where with us, so often, we get discouraged, we get despondent, we get down and out, even at the smallest trial and test, and we feel sorry for ourselves. It seems that we hardly have to go through sometimes hardly anything before we start feeling sorry for ourselves. And I can't imagine what we would be like if we went through what poor Job went through. What would our attitude be? How would we respond? I can't imagine having to go through what Job suffered. Job knew about sore trials. He knew about tests. But when it came on him, it confused him. He didn't understand it. He said, "I've obeyed, I've loved God, I've served God. Why is all this happening to me? Why is this come upon me the way that it has?" God used the trials to develop strength and character in Job, but Satan used the same identical trials to try to destroy Job, to get him discouraged, to get him despondent, to tear down character, and to develop self-righteousness instead of true righteousness. Job 3 and verse 24 through 26, he said, "For my sighing comes before I eat." He said, "I get no pleasure at all. I can't find rest. I can't find peace. Even eating is a chore. And my groanings pour out like water. For the thing that I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened unto me. I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes." And life does get rough sometimes. He said, "I was doing what I should be doing, but trouble came anyway." He didn't understand why God either caused it or allowed it to be upon him. Then in Job 4 and 5, Eliphaz the Temanite, waxes eloquent, and he tells Job that he's being punished because of his sins. It's black and white. It's clear. It's just, you know, this is the way it is. You're being punished because you have sinned, and you will not acknowledge that. And if you were obeying God, then you would be blessed, plain and simple. And in Job, the sixth chapter, Job told Eliphaz in so many words that he was all wet, and Job prayed again that God would just take his life, that he would let him die and get him out of his misery. He told Eliphaz that when he was down and out, when he was suffering and he needed comfort, here comes Eliphaz, and all he did is, oh joy, he just condemned him. You're picking on me. Then in Job 7, in verse 3 through 7, says, so I have been allotted months of futility. Apparently this went on for some length of time. We're not told how long or whatever, but it does say, I have been allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise? His nights were miserable. He couldn't sleep. He tossed, he turned, he hurt. He was just absolutely miserable. When shall I arise? And the night ended. For I have had my fill of tossing until dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. Apparently Job had black leprosy so bad that maggots were actually eating on his rotten, putrefying flesh. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. He had given up. He felt like there was no hope. Oh, remember that my life is as a breath, and my eyes shall never see good again. Job felt like it was more than he could endure, it was more than he could bear, and it certainly was more than he could understand. Job lost all hope for the future. Isn't that the way that Satan tries to get to us? Doesn't he try to get our mind off of our great calling? Doesn't he try to get our mind onto the problem that besets us rather than our minds wrapped around God and his way and the tremendous hope and future that we have? He tries to get our mind off of the kingdom and onto ourselves. Then in verse 11 of Job 7, therefore I will not restrain my mouth. He says, in other words, I've suffered enough that I have earned the right to complain. So he said, I will not restrain my mouth, and I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. He felt like he had that right. Haven't we known people that are like that, that they feel like they have the right to complain and even blame God? In verse 20, the King James Version says, I have sinned. Job really was not repenting here. He just knew the right words to say. He just knew the proper expression, and he said, I have sinned. But this, at this point, was not true repentance. As a matter of fact, in the rest of verse 20 and 21, Job puts the blame right back on God. He said, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target, so I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be here. In other words, he was just ready to lay down and die. He was ready to lay down and quit eating and just lay there and die, that he was down that far. Huge characteristic of self-righteousness is that they judge everyone else and even judge God. You've heard the expression that says when you point at someone else and blaming them, you've got three fingers pointing back to you and one pointing up to God blaming him. And that's true. and that is true self-righteousness, people that blame others, that put the blame onto others and never accept the blame for themselves. They say that they're wrong, they mouth the words, but down deep, they cannot comprehend it inside of themselves. They feel submissive, they feel humble, but instead they are vain and puffed up with their own self-righteousness. So we see that the self-righteous, number one, judge others, and number two, they transfer guilt onto other people, that they, number three, do not really see and understand themselves. They say they're wrong, but they truly cannot admit it, like that they really do have a problem, that no one understands them. Job the 8th chapter, Bildad the Shuhite comes to the rescue, and he chimes in with the same theme as Eliphaz. Job, you're a sinner, and you are being punished because you're a sinner, and if you would just repent, then everything will be okay. Job, if you would just trust the Lord, then everything's going to be good. Good old Bildad, shortest man in the Bible. Bildad the Shuhite. Well, either that or you had a big shoe. I don't know which. And of course, they say the smallest man in the Bible was a centurion that slept on his watch. Of course, he might have had this gigantic watch. I don't know. But anyway, here we find Bildad came to the same conclusion that Job, it's your fault, it's your problem, which most of the time that's true. But in Job's case, it was not true. God was refining Job's character. In Job the 9th chapter, verses 1 through 3, truly I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. In other words, Job knew what Bildad was saying, but he said, it doesn't really apply to me. Then Job said that you don't stand a chance against God. That if God's out to get you, then he's going to get you no matter what. You don't have a prayer. He looked at God as being cruel, as being hateful. And isn't it amazing how so many times we forget all of the good, the wonderful things that God has done for us, and we just focus on the problem or the current situation or trial and test that we're going through. In Job 9 and verse 20 through 22, Job 9 and verse 20. Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. He's saying it doesn't do any good. Why try? How many people have we known that have had the same identical attitude of giving up? What's the use? I tried, but I still had these trials and tests and problems. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. I am blameless, and yet I do not know myself, and I despise my life. It is all one thing, therefore I say, he destroys blameless and the wicked. Wow. Now Job is getting quite bold with his comments about God and blaming God because he was suffering, while Job was righteous. He had now made the leap from pure, unadulterated righteousness to total, complete self-righteousness. Job was saying in so many words, God, you let me down. I'm disappointed in you. We see here that Job was struggling. He didn't want to be self-righteous, but he began to depend more on himself and on his righteousness than depending upon God. In verse 27 through 31, he said, if I say, I will forget my complaint, and I will put off my sad face and wear a smile. In other words, if I just try to put on a front, if I just try to, you know, fool everybody, and I go around grinning like a possum. He said, I'm afraid of all of my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? Why not just give up? Why not just quit? He said, if I wash myself with snow water, which was the purest water he could find at that time. Of course, snow now is polluted around the face of the earth. But he said, if I could wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will purge me into the pit, and my clothes will abhor me. I'm sure they were very uncomfortable. He wore the least amount he could possibly wear because he couldn't stand for anything to touch his skin. Job knew better than to just chunk it down the drain. So either way, he felt like he couldn't win. That if he tried, he was going to lose. If he didn't try, he was going to lose. So what's the use? Job the 10th chapter in verse 1. Job 10 and verse 1 through 3. My soul loathes my life, and I will give free course to my complaint. He again states, I've suffered so much, I have the right to complain. The good old song, you know, that nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Well, he hopped on, as we say, Job's horse, Isme, and he says, woe is me. You know, nobody understands, nobody's been through this, and that's true. I don't think anybody up to that point had ever been through the horrible tragedies and suffering that Job went through. But he said, I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. He even realized that a root of bitterness had set in. Where there was joy, where there was love, where there was adoration for God, now there was bitterness in his soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked, that here they're blessed and look what I'm going through? He said, does that seem right to you, God? He said, I know that I might have needed to be corrected, but man alive, this is killing me. Surely you didn't mean for this to happen. Satan really has Job discouraged and thinking about himself. Because of the trials that he was going through, everything began to be turned inward and self-centered. In verse 6 through 13 of Job 10, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin, although you know that I'm not wicked. He said, you're not going to find it. And there is no one who can deliver from your hand. Your hands have made and fashioned me an intricate unity, and yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay, and that you will turn me into dust again. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bone and sinew? You have granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. And these things you have hidden in your heart. That God wasn't acknowledging it, in other words. And I know that this was with you. So Job here is lamenting, God, you used to love me, but obviously now you don't love me anymore. Whatever happened to that? Why do you want to destroy me? All I want to do is your will. All I want to do is love you. And Job is beginning to fall headlong deeper and deeper into self-righteousness. In verse 14 of Job 10, verse 14 through 16. If I sin, then you mark me, and you will not acquit me of my iniquity. Job certainly didn't believe in God's mercy and tenderness and compassion and grace. If I am wicked, woe to me. Even if I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head, and I am full of disgrace. See my misery. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion, and again you show yourselves awesome against me. So he was confused about how a loving, kind God could allow him to go through all of this tragedy. Job began to look more and more to his own strength, to his own righteousness, because he felt that God had let him down, that God had left him, and that God had let him down, that God no longer loved him. In Job 11, Zophar didn't get so far, but he began to get a glimmer, at least, into what Job's problem had become. Not that it started that way, but now Job had become very self-righteous. Job 11 and verse 4 said, "For you have said, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in your eyes." So Zophar said that the right words, and he began to hit the nail on the head, but he did not truly comprehend it. He said that Job was self-righteous, but he really didn't understand it when he said it. Then in verse 6, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquities deserve. Wow, the ultimate blow came from his, quote, friend, end quote. He said, Job, you really need to be punished a lot more than you have been. And it's like the old saying goes, when you've got friends like that, who needs enemies? You know, here he was down and out, and he said, you haven't suffered nearly enough yet. And then in Job 12 and verse 1, then Job answered and said, no doubt you are the people. Boy, you're the ones, you know, you're the greatest, and wisdom will die with you. He said, touche. He said, I know you're really something else. And when you die, all of the wisdom's going to be gone off of the face of the earth, and the world will be completely void of any sense and wisdom. And then in verse 3, Job said, well, I'm as good as you are. And now Job really begins to look to himself. In Job 13, in verses 1 through 5, behold, my eye has seen all of this, and my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. Let God come here and reason with me, because I know I'm right and he's wrong. But he said, you, in verse 4, but you forgers of lies, you are all worthless physicians. You come here to help me, and you've done nothing but cause harm. Oh, that you would be silent. He said, why don't you just shut up? And it would be your wisdom then. He said, you know, if you just shut up, you'd be a lot smarter, or at least I'd think you were smarter. Now he's just 100% self. Something that started as a small crack in Job's character has now blossomed and bloomed into full-blown 100% self-righteousness. Verse 13, hold your peace with me and let me speak. In other words, he's telling God to be quiet even, besides the three friends. Let me say what I have to say. I'll talk to God, and God will understand that he's mistreating me. He says, hold your peace with me and let me speak, and then come on me what may. In other words, just leave me alone. Now, more and more, self-righteousness is showing up. No one understands me type of attitude. And oh, woe is me. He hopped on that old horse again, is me. And woe is me. Nobody understands. And they didn't. In verse 15 through 19, though he slay me, yet I will trust him. Even though God's unrighteous, I'm righteous, and I'll still trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him, and he also shall be my salvation. For a hypocrite could not come before him. Listen carefully to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See now, I have prepared my case, and I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he that will contend with me? If I now hold my tongue, I perish. Now Job is really singing that old song and dance, nobody knows the trouble I've seen. I know I'm physical. I know that I probably need some type of correction, but I don't know why God is doing this to me, why he was suffering so much. In Job 14, he lost all hope in life. His only hope was in the resurrection, and he was ready to again just give up, give it all up, and roll over and quit and die. In Job 15, Eliphaz is up to bat again, and he pretty much called Job a big bag of wind, and you think you're the smartest man that ever lived and so forth. And then in Job 16, Job turns around and calls the three of them a big bag of wind, and said they were very sorry comforters and did not do a good job at that. In verse 4 and 5 of Job 16, Job says, I could also speak as you do. You know, I could start railing on you. I could start pointing out your sins and your problems. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I'm so good, he said, I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. And so Job said, you know, you condemn me, but if you were in my place and I was in your place, I'm so good that I would comfort you and I would love you and I would pat you on the back. And then Job continues on with his lament that no one has suffered like he has, and he continued to place blame on God. Job 18, here comes Bildad again up to bat and basically tells Job to shut up and to listen to the three of them, that they know what the problem is. Then in Job 19, Job said he was like old Leroy Brown. Why is everybody always picking on me? Because he felt like they had just all ganged up on him and they didn't have any idea what they were talking about. And he continues to say that not only were they against him, but God had turned against him too. Then in chapter 20, Zophar is at it again. And then in Job 22, Eliphaz chimes in again. Then in chapter 23, in verse 1 through 17, Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groanings. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, referring to God, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, he said, but he would take note of me. In other words, if I could just talk to God, if God would come here and let me talk to him, I could get this mess straightened out. There the upright could reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. Look, I go forward, but he's not there, and backwards, but I cannot perceive him. When he works on the left hand, I cannot behold him. When he turns on the right hand, I cannot see him. But he knows the way that I take, and when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot is held fast to his steps, and I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandments of his lips, and I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. Verse 13, but he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. In other words, he's beginning to again blame God, because he said, you know, he can do this and there's not a thing I can do about it. For he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore I am terrified in his presence. He used to love to be in God's presence. Now through his self-righteousness, he's terrified to be in God's presence. When I consider this, I'm afraid of him. For God made my heart weak, and the Almighty terrifies me, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face. Here in this chapter, in 17 verses, I, me, and my is used 40 times, and we're going to see a progression as he gets deeper and deeper into self-centeredness and self-righteousness. Does that in any way sound like anyone's prayers that you know? It's all I, it's all me, it's all my, all self. He complains that God is hiding from him, and if he could only talk to God, then God, and if God would only listen, then he could convince God that he's not done anything wrong and that he doesn't deserve this, but God had gone way off and doesn't hear him. I pray, but God does not hear. Job 25, Bildad's back to the rescue this time, but then in chapter 26, Job cuts off Bildad's water. Then in Job 27, in verse 1 through 6, moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice? See, if God was just, then I wouldn't be treated like this. But God has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I will hold fast, his self-righteousness, and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. He was not willing to admit that now a problem had set in, a very, very deep spiritual problem, and that of self-righteousness. He said, I'm right, and I uphold my righteousness. It's just me and God, and actually God is mistreating me, so I'm more righteous than God is. Every time one of Job's friends would correct him, Job was quick to justify himself. That's one of the keys of self-righteousness. In chapter 29, Job talked about the good old days, back when God loved him and God blessed him, but now God doesn't love him and God has taken everything away. Then in verse 11 through 17, Job 29, he said, because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper. And that's wonderful. That's pure religion. As God said, as we're going to see, he did some wonderful, wonderful things here. But he became vain and proud and puffed up as a result. And I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. Or pardon me, the blessing, verse 13, the blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. And I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. My eye was eyes for the blind, and I was feet to the lame, and I was a father to the poor, and I searched out a case that I did not know. He tried to find people to help, which is wonderful. And I broke the fangs of the wicked, and I plucked the victim from its teeth. In other words, oh wow, look how wonderful and look how great I am. I, me, and my used 57 times in chapter 29. You notice a progression of self-centeredness and self-righteousness. Job 30. Job's mind was totally wrapped up in self, completely self-centered, self-righteous. Everything was about me, myself, and I. Verse 20 through 23, Job continues to blame God. I and me and my is used 58 times in Job 30. In Job 31, I, me, and my is used 82 times. It's amazing the self-justification that we find here with Job. You know, Mr. Armstrong used to say that the hardest thing for a human being to do is admit that they are wrong. And if you do not take correction well, if you try to justify yourself, if you place the blame onto others, then there's a great chance that you are self-righteous. If you feel confused when you're corrected, if you don't understand what God is doing, then there's a great chance that you're self-righteous. Job 32 and verse 1. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. You see, that was the problem. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job, and his wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. So Elihu finally began to see and understand now where the problem lies. Young Elihu hit the nail on the head, and God saw the problem that had developed in Job through the trials and the test that he went through. The more you are corrected, and the more you try to justify yourself, rather than taking it and developing character, Christ died without ever saying, "I told you I was right." Elihu begins to point out Job's problem of self-righteousness in Job 33 and verses 8 through 12. He said, "Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words, saying, 'I am pure without transgression. I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me.' And yet he finds occasion against me. He counts me as an enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks, and he watches my paths. Look in this, you are not righteous, and I will answer you, for God is greater than man." And truly he is. Elihu began to see Job's problem of self-righteousness, of totally being self-centered, and that everything revolved around him. Then in Job 34 and verse 5, "For Job said, 'I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice.'" Pointed that finger right back to God and blamed God. So Elihu closes in more and more on Job's problem of self-righteousness. Then in verse 9 through 13, "For he had said, 'It profits a man nothing that he should delight in God.'" He said, what's the use? I mean, to go through all this, I served God, I loved God, I tried as hard as I could, I did things right, I never strayed, I never sinned. What is the point and what is the purpose? He said, "It profits a man nothing that he should delight in God. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. For he repays man according to his work, and makes man to find a reward according to his way. Surely God will never do wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. Who gave him charge over the earth, or who appointed him over the whole world?" So Elihu points out Job's problem here of self-righteousness and that of accusing God. And there's a grave danger of self-righteousness when people begin to blame God. Don't get bitter at God. Realize that whatever's going on in your life, God is in charge. He knows. He loves you. He's pulling for you. He wants you to develop his mind, nature, and character inside of you. Then in Job 35 and verse 1 and 2, "Moreover, Elihu answered and said, 'Do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's?'" As he began to see a huge crack and problem now with Job. "Well, I prayed about it. I trusted God, and he let me down. After all I wanted to do was do God's will, and God punished me for it." Then in verse 12 and 13 of Job 35, "There they cry out, but he does not answer. Because of the pride of evil men, surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it." Our vanity, our pride, our selfishness and our self-righteousness separates us from God. Self-righteousness prevents us from seeing our own sins and our own problems. Because at this point, Job had a major, major sin and problem, and he could not see it because of the self-righteousness. And then Elihu goes on and he talks about the work of God in chapter 36 and 37. And the problem with those that judge God's work is self-righteousness, that they feel like that they are better than the work, they're better than God, and that they do not trust God, but rather they trust that they have the answers, and they put their faith in themselves rather than in God to be in charge of His church. Sure, human beings make mistakes. Absolutely, we are human. But God is in charge. This is the church of the living Jesus Christ. And when we stand in judgment of it, we're only standing in judgment of Jesus Christ. Job, the 38th chapter, verse 1. We find that the situation got so bad that finally God had to come down and talk to Job and in so many words say, "Who in the world do you think you are, bud? Talk about me like that? Talk against me like that? Where do you think you came from, and who do you think you are?" Job 38 and verse 1. "Then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, 'Who is this who darkens counsels by words without knowledge?'" You're saying stuff you don't even understand. "Now prepare yourself like a man." He said, "You want to talk to me? Stand up. And I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." Job became so self-reliant and so self-righteous that God himself intervened. And he asked Job, "Who do you think you are, bud?" In Job 38 and 39, God said in so many words, "Job, you have no idea how great God truly is, and who do you think you are?" And then in Job 40, verses 1 through 5, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.' And then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am vile.'" Now this time, it was true repentance. When he really saw who God was, and he compared himself with God, instead of comparing himself with his friends and with others, he began to see himself and he said, "I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. I don't deserve to talk to God. That's a privilege. That's an honor. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer now. Yes, twice. But I will proceed no further." He began to realize that, look, I'm nothing. And here's God, this great, wonderful being, and he began to see himself slightly. And then in verse 6, God again lets Job know how puny and insignificant he really was. Then in chapter 41, God tells Job that his power didn't even compare to Leviathan's strength and might and power, much less to God's strength and power that he had. Then in Job 42, in verse 1, through 6. "And then Job answered the Lord and said, 'I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You ask, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You say, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, because of that, I abhor myself and I repent in dust and ashes." Now, it wasn't just words or an expression or a feeling to Job. He had come to talk to God, and God let him know how puny and insignificant that Job was. And now it had meaning. Now it brought about repentance. He said, "I heard before," but he said, "but man, now I understand. Now I comprehend." It was a thought. It was a faith. It was knowledge before, but now I truly see and understand. not just words, but the reality of the grandeur of God. Have we in our conversion come to that point yet? Or are we still basking in the glory of our own self-righteousness? Hard, hard lesson to learn. Because of the deep repentance of Job, and because of God's great, tremendous mercy and compassion, this story has a wonderful and beautiful ending. In verse 10 of Job 42, "And the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before." And in verse 12, "Now the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, twice as much as he had before, 1,000 yoke of oxen and 1,000 female donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters," even replaced children. I mean, you can't do that, obviously. But he blessed him and gave him children and grandchildren, as we're going to see. "And he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Kisra, and the name of the third Karen Huppuk. And in all the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job. And their father gave them an inheritance along with their brothers. And this Job lived 140 years and saw his children," or after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his grandchildren for 4 generations. So Job died old and full of days. A happy ending, but a very vital lesson for all of us. I have put out on the table right outside the door on your left as you go out a sheet on 2 sides. First thing is 12 characteristics of self-righteousness. And it goes through things that we brought out in all 3 of these points. And then I put 12 ways to overcome self-righteousness. So I would encourage you to pick up one of these. I hope that this series has been very profitable. I hope it has given us a lot of meat for thought, because God hates self-righteousness. As I mentioned in the first series, that Jesus Christ fought constantly against the self-righteousness of the Pharisees and of the scribes. And he hates it. And when it's in us, God cannot stand it. And so he really works with us to root that out. So think about the 3. If you have not heard the first 2, please see Mr. Davis. Or like I said, go online and get those, because they do go hand in hand, one with another. All 3 tie in together.